Welcome to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are a voluntary association of students of the philosophy of theosophy. Our program here in Philadelphia consists of two weekly meetings on Sunday mornings from 11 to 12. We have a formal presentation of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and their application in many areas of life, usually in the format of a short talk or a panel, as we have it today. And the theme, the overall theme for the month of March is the mystery of the mind, or mysteries of the mind. And this morning, we are taking up the subject of the unity and the duality of mind. On Wednesday evenings from 7:45 to 9 p.m., we have a study class in the Ocean of Theosophy. We've just completed a few chapters in that book on reincarnation and karma. And for the next several weeks, we're going to be studying another mystery, that of the after-death states, and we see that it is a natural process in life involving the separation of the human principles, but we'll have more about that at our Wednesday meeting. In addition to these meetings, which are free and open to the public, we have a library on the first floor here, which is open from 5:30 till 7:30. On Wednesday evening. It is a reference library. You can find there straight line theosophical books, literature on all different departments of science, philosophy, religion, art, and of course the particular assignment and reference for that meeting. There's also a volunteer student librarian available to help you search out whatever particular subject you're interested in. In addition, on the first floor in the center of the building here, we have a book table upon which are displayed straight-line theosophical literature, the original photographic reprints of the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, as well as several devotional books, magazines, and other theosophical literature, which are available for your investigation and home study. The cost of these materials only includes the publication and shipping. There is no profit made by the sale of these books. All the activities of the lodge, including the maintenance of the lodge, is sustained entirely by voluntary contributions and time, service, and money by those who wish to contribute. There is no obligation imposed or implied. The bond that unites any branch of the United Lodge of Theosophists, and those branches are as independent in their operation as are the individual associates of those lodges, are all held together by a single document called the Declaration of the United Lodge of Theosophists, which is so important that you really should take the time and read it and study it for yourselves. There's always copies available at the usher's table. But we'd like to read it this morning. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all those who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization. And it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So as we mentioned this morning, we are beginning our investigation of the mysteries of the mind with the consideration of the unity and duality of mind. The first presentation will be on the unity of mind, and that will be followed by a short presentation on its duality. And then we'll open the meeting for your questions, comments, and answers. So the philosophy of theosophy approaches every mystery of life in the light of universal principles or fundamental principles, which can be applied to any particular situation. So we might begin our consideration of the unity of mind with thinking about the unity of mind in nature. So, starting with a fundamental principle of theosophy, that all is one, interconnected, interdependent, because everything has ultimately come from one source. And so there is an underlying unity in all the diversity of forms and beings. This one source that we speak of is unmanifested, infinite, and eternal. And in the philosophy of theosophy, we call it deity or the deific principle, rather than using the term God, because for so many individuals, the word God is symbolic and conjures up an image of a supreme being. But we're presenting an idea of deity that is infinite and eternal and not limited by the attributes of being. So having no beginning or ending, it certainly could not be less than space, which has no beginning and ending and is all-inclusive of all beings and attributes and forms, and yet in itself, space has no, is not a being, it's not a form, and it has no attributes. So in the same way, this deific principle is not a being, it is no thing, and it has no attributes. It includes all. And yet periodically, the entire manifested universe appears from within this one eternal source. And as soon as we have manifestation, duality appears. And so we have spirit and matter or substance. In reality, they are two sides of the same reality. Just as the face has two sides or a coin has two sides, it's still one reality, but it can be viewed from different perspectives. And so spirit is the source of all consciousness, degrees of intelligence, degrees of force in the universe, and substance is the source of all the different varieties of forms and beings we have. And so every being then is a blend of substance and some degree of spirit. Every being then is alive, conscious, intelligent in some degree. And therefore the principle of mind is also present to some degree in every department of nature. So we move then from the consideration of mind as a unity or a unifying principle in nature to the consideration of mind as a unity in the human being. So all the attributes that we usually think about in terms of mind, awareness, intelligence, memory, sentience, will, all these are present, as we've said, in every department of nature to some degree. Mind is a universal principle in nature, and it is a unifying principle in each and every human being. And that'll become more clear of us to us as we proceed. Every being, every human being, rather, is a mind being, say, capable of self-consciousness, self-analyzing reflection, free will, and choice, and considering the stream of continuing thoughts, feelings, memories, imaginings, desires that we are all familiar with, it is fair to say that we all live in the mind. And so, in spite of all these changes in the mind, all the changes in our personality, all the changes in our circumstances, in our conditions, in our environment, each one of us is aware that we are an unchanging observer, witness, experiencer, and thinker. In every moment of our waking consciousness, for as long as we can remember, we are aware of our being that observer or that mind being. So this mind principle in the human being in Sanskrit is called manas. And when we think about it, it is the source of our individuality as human beings. Each one of us knows we are the same mind being throughout the entire duration of our experience. Yet how we use our minds, the ideas we hold, the choices we make as mind beings is what determines our differences as human beings. There we see the unity in diversity. So the mystery then of the mind is, how did we acquire or how did we become these individual self-conscious thinkers? So let's begin again with the idea that all beings in their spiritual essence are a ray or a spark of universal spirit, and all beings contain to some degree to some way of manifesting that mind. So as a being in any department of nature evolves, becomes more complex in its form, its capacity to manifest that inner mind nature also expands. The human form reflects all the different departments of nature. There are mineral elements in our nature, there are plant elements in our nature, and of course there are animal elements of nature in the human being. But the human being is even more than that, more complex than all those departments. And so it is uniquely capable of being the vehicle of a self-conscious mind. And this occurred, it is said in the philosophy, 18 million years ago. At that point, the evolution of the human form had reached a point where it was ready, and the potential for for self-consciousness. In that spiritual essence that was always latent there, was lit up and activated by those who had acquired that self-consciousness in long preceding ages in former cycles of evolution. And this was accomplished by the incarnation in full or in part of mind beings in those senseless human forms. As a result, those human forms became what we would call human beings, self-conscious thinking entities in a human form capable of free will and choice, as we now recognize the human nature. And if we are thinking about this, how we can understand this process by analogy, it is suggested that we use the idea of a candle, how a single candle can light a multitude of other candles. The potentiality for the flame is within that candle. It just needs the right spark, the right conditions, the right contact to bring it forth. And so we say that potential for self-consciousness is within all the kingdoms, but it needs to be lit up by the contact with another self-conscious being. We might also think of the relationship between a parent and a child. It's not just a physical and emotional relationship. It's a mental contact. And all the ideas and values and lessons and attitudes and truths of the parent through the contact with the child are lit up and incorporated and become active in the mind of the child. Now that's a double-edged sword, because we can pass on the truths we know as also the falsehoods and prejudices, because the young mind is so susceptible. But nevertheless, we can understand how there is a passing on, a lighting up in the intelligence by that contact. So each human being then, from that point on, became in its spiritual inner nature, real inner nature, an incarnating mind being using a long succession of temporary personalities. So our individuality in truth is that mind being, and we live in a unified ocean of humanity because every human being we see that has been on this earth or will be in the future is also a mind being, a pilgrim soul, gaining experience on this plane through a long series of incarnations. So from this idea of the unity of mind and its origin, we'll proceed then to a discussion or presentation of the diversity of mind.
Or a presentation of the duality of mind.
Diversity.
That's okay.
Yeah, duality.
So once the mind incarnates into a human form, it by definition is dual. We speak of the duality of mind. And the reason for that simply is, on the one hand, at this period of evolution, mind has not fully been able to incarnate into the form. Why? Because the form has not evolved to the point where it can serve as a fully as a vehicle for mind. And so we have what some people might call the pairs of opposites, but really when we talk about the duality of mind and the duality of the powers of mind, it's not so much just the pairs of opposites. It's actually a fine line of demarcation sometimes, and we'll explain a few things. For instance, everybody knows the difference between hate and pleasure, or hate and love, and pleasure and pain. Those are pairs of opposites. But discernment to grasp the twofold powers of the mind is divided by a fine line that actually can make certain powers of the mind divine or devilish. So, for instance, can we discern, does the average person discern between the difference between ambition and aspiration? Does the average individual discern clearly between, discern the difference between faith and belief? How about imagination and fancy? Is enthusiasm the same as fanaticism? How about love and infatuation? If we're able to discern the difference between these two, we'd be able to solve a lot of life's problems before they even come up in our lives. And it has to do with the difference between what we'll call the higher mind and the lower mind, the incarnated mind and the yet unincarnated aspect of mind. And so more frankly, we'll just stay with the lower mind and the higher mind. The lower mind is anchored in what we call our emotional seat of passions and desires. The Sanskrit word for that is kama. And then the higher mind is illumined on the other side by our wisdom, by the spiritual soul, or the light of buddhi, which is the Sanskrit term for spiritual soul. So that which pretty much seem to be the same mind powers, and our inability to discern between the two can be the cause of some problems. So let's take a look at some. First, let's consider the difference between faith and belief. Faith looks directly to the heart of things. And faith, theosophically speaking, when one puts faith in something, one recognizes that there is a law at work. And one would place faith in the possibility of a thing only when one, you know, knows that under law it can come about, and having faith is step one in bringing that thing about. Whereas blind belief in something is grounded in ignorance, it's grounded in fear, it's grounding in not taking responsibility for your own mind, because you'll just believe because an outside authority will tell you to believe it. Although the average man may see them kind of more alike the same, they're very different. For instance, how is one who is strong in convictions of the church, who feels and senses and recognizes intuitively that deity is the reality? This is true. But if he is grounded in the ideas of the church, of God as a being, Jesus performs miracles, his soul is saved, these ideas, theosophically speaking, are false ideas. So while the idea of, or the feeling, or the intuition of deity is true, the dogmas of the church are false, and that is the basis for a lot of problems in the Western world. Ideally, in the theosophical movement, is kept in being by the faith, the will of its great founders, and by the workers within the movement. This is not blind belief. No one is invited to come here and sit here and listen and believe what you hear. No one's expected to swallow everything that you hear, but just consider it, compare it to other ideas that may be contrary, and discern for yourself which is the truth. The idea of keep the faith. Keep the faith means just to hold the vision, to steadfastly act on the as the basis for the vision alone. Another idea, or two ideas, is that of receptivity and passivity. This, theosophically speaking, is a very important distinction, because of all of the functions of the human mind, the ability for our mind to be impressed with ideas is perhaps the most important function. If we could not be impressed with ideas, we could not learn from others, we could not teach others. But on the other hand, we couldn't be misled and deceived by others either. Well, the fact is, the human mind is impressionable, and it is receptive. The difference between receptivity and passivity is receptivity is the individual who is receptive is active on the plane of mind and discerns the ideas presented and chooses to accept or reject those ideas. Whereas the passive mind, which is a passive attitude, is the downfall of every medium. It's the problems that so many people have when we get into philosophic and religious ideas, because people can be swayed by cult leaders, etc. And theosophy exhorts us to maintain control of what you accept or reject, you know, just as sure as we should be able to receive or be receptive to true ideas, we also have the power to repel false ideas. And if we don't repel false ideas, then they can take root in our mind if we're not wary. This goes on all the time. We are in our world, we are completely surrounded by influences, true and false, 24/7, whether it's through the TV shows and the commercials we watch, the radios that we hear, and on the astral plane, which we may not even be aware that we're being impressed by, but we are being impressed by it. So those are some ideas of the duality of receptivity and passivity. Then, you know, everyone, isn't it natural for all people to want to be free? We talk about, you know, how important it was that America was established for the freedom, the individual's freedom. But there's another side to freedom. And a lot of times when people use the word freedom, what we're really talking about is license. So, for instance, some feel that it's through economic equilibrium where everybody gets enough to satisfy their wants that they'll be free. Some people would say that if we make certain adjustments in society so that though that which was maladjusted in society is now fixed, that there'll be more freedom. But really, if everybody is working to get what they want, then isn't the basis for that personal desires? And if we get what we want, don't we just become more bound to the stuff that we get? If we're dependent upon things to feel free, really, we're binding ourselves to those things and we're never free. What is bound, truly, theosophically speaking, is the soul. And every time we make an effort to get something for me because I want it, and you know, we hear the word free in so many commercials, we'll free ourselves of this if we only own that, really, we bind the soul which with each new possession that we think is going to get free. And so that's really license of it's emotionally based, it's sporadic. Freedom, theosophically speaking, is freedom from all of the things of this world. So how is it, here's another thing. How is it possible in a world of changing standards among people of varying capacities and limitations for a society to provide the conditions suited for the needs of all so everybody will feel free? The individual needs to take the steps for himself to understand the difference between license and freedom. And that's really what theosophy is here for, is so that we don't fall into the delusion that the things of this world that we think are going to make us happy are going to. Because as soon as we acquire them, we're looking for something new of this world. Some say that the road to freedom is down the highway of inventions and science, yet the more things that science invents, you know, better living through chemistry was DuPont's slogan for a long time. the more science provides for us, the more we expect more from science. All right, so then we'll move on to one more. There's quite a few of them. Then there's enthusiasm versus fanaticism. Mr. Judge encourages us, really, when we study, to always have a dictionary at hand so that we can look up the meanings, the archaic meanings or the etymology of the words that we're reading. Because as we're probably all aware, enthusiasm comes from the idea of the God within. And theosophically speaking, there's a huge difference between an enthusiastic individual and a fanatic. An enthusiastic individual is one who is calm and who recognizes the value of whatever the pursuit is and is constant in the pursuit of it. And we may recognize the benefits or the beneficence of enthusiasm, but we will feel the beneficence of enthusiasm rather than see it. Fanaticism, on the other hand, is here today and gone tomorrow. It's about something that I can touch, feel, hear, or see, or it's a religious fad. Think of the difference, perhaps, between the benefits of an art enthusiast who donates fantastic works to the local art museum so that everybody can benefit from it, as opposed to the music enthusiast that you catch at a music fanatic that you might catch at a concert with the latest fad rock and roll or something. That's the difference. So there's a few other options, but we don't want to go over time. So that being considered, any ideas, contributions, or questions are certainly invited for discussion. Yes, in the black.
It was mentioned that mind is not fully incarnate in the world we live. But we have people in the past that have shown great, great minds, like Pythagoras, Plato, you know, Buddha, Jesus. They all had some quality of wisdom and mind. How did they achieve that? Was that a gift, or where did it come from?
So the question has to do with, if it were, and it is possible, that mind would be fully incarnated, what's necessary to do that? And what that has to do, we think, is first realize that when we talk about the higher mind and the lower mind, where each individual is where he is. That's his and her own consciousness. And one can tell the difference within oneself if there are changes over time by how, as we said, how calm and constant are we in the patterns of our lives, or how sporadic are things going. You know, the lower mind is grounded in the personal desires, the higher mind is guided by universal wisdom. Now, one who is a fully evolved human being lives in the higher mind, and because he has been able to detach himself from all of the desires, the personal stuff that most people want. How does that happen? Simply, you know, the human being is personally responsible for his own evolution. Now, of course, if we decide, well, I'm going to evolve myself faster than everybody else, that's a short circuit. It's not going to happen. It happens by means of living for others and assisting others in the whole world in the way we think, live, and share. It's the effect of causes that, the universal effect of universal causes that we put up. And it is possible. And the effect of this is that individuals can and do evolve faster if they create the conditions within their experiences in each life. And once they do evolve to a higher place, you know, they have greater recognition of the unity of all, and it's always greater and greater recognition that we have, the unity of all, which validates and gives us greater conviction that we are all a brotherhood. And the more we get out of our own stuff and into the higher principles, allow ourselves at least to be guided by the principles of higher mind, so we're on the path toward that. Yes? Oh, okay. Okay, yes, you had your hand up. Yes.
This concept of a duality of mind implies that there's a time or place or something where the duality is gone.
So the duality of mind implies that there's a time and place where the duality is not there. Surely. And the duality is not there before we incarnate. Mind is a principle in and of itself. And then once a human being has evolved to the point where he is no longer attached and influenced by personal stuff, then he's operating fully in the higher mind. And so it's a temporary dual situation as long as we're in these physical bodies at this stage of evolution.
So remember the idea of spirit and matter being two aspects of the same reality. There's only one mind being, but it has two aspects, and we're, for the purposes of discernment in their activity, we're calling them higher and lower, but they both have the same capacities and powers. It's just one aspect or array of it is caught up in the desires and in the body, and its activity is limited to that influence. And yet it is possible in certain states of consciousness, through certain effort, to raise that lower mind and blend it to the higher. And that unity or that oneness has given several indications in different languages. It may be called samadhi or yoga, which means union, but it's the uniting in one consciousness of our lower and higher nature. So there is no separateness in reality. You had your hand up.
Yeah, I'd like to contribute something I wrote the other day. I was thinking about this kind of stuff. It's a little haiku. Haiku. Matter trapped in space. Undulating, slow rhythms. Never not spirit.
Never not
spirit.
Never not spirit. We never were good at interpreting poems. It's not one of our strengths. However, we cannot think of matter as not spirit or ever separate from spirit. We have to get back to that fundamental idea of the one reality. Even in physics, what we consider light is understood by physics to have a dual aspect. It is spiritual, it is energy, it is force, it undulates like a wave, and it is also a substance. It's molecular motion. And this is true in every department of nature. Wherever we see manifestation, there is some degree of substance working, some degree of form, and at the same time, there is some degree of spirit or consciousness. Now, that degree of consciousness or spirit may be so subdued, so apparently inert that we don't see it, just like certain light bulbs. It's a bare flicker, and at other times it's turned up real bright. But it's there in potential and can be brought out. So, yes, matter is everywhere in space. It never was not. It always will be. It's continuously transforming itself, and yet moving, inspiring, driving all those changes in matter is that eternal expression of spirit or force or consciousness.
Yes?
Principle of deity is something I don't fully understand. All these things come to mind, like, for example, noumenon can be, in my mind, make sense as a principle of deity. Also non-duality, you know? But if all these things are the principle of deity, then that's before you get into this realm of consciousness. It's pure potentiality. So I was wondering if you could help me understand that a little bit better.
Well, maybe we could understand it by another analogy.
Okay, so
the question is, you know, is there a way we can better come to understand the principle of deity? And examples were given, such as, you know, what is this noumenon? Is that a part of deity, etc.? So the example we would give is, let's say we lived in a world where it was impossible just to dig a hole underground. But at the same time, we saw the trees growing, we saw the flowers blooming, and everything else in nature was occurring, but we had no idea what was going on underground. In that world, it would be reasonable to discern that there must be something going on underground that we can't see, and that the flower isn't just going to come up out of nothing. It has to be the effect of a cause. And of course, we all know that the cause is the germination of the bulb and attracting the nutrients, you know. But if you can't see it, that doesn't mean that you can't discern the principle that must be in operation, unless you believe that the flower is a miracle, which theosophy dismisses entirely. Well, in the world in which we live, we don't have the capacity to see, to know, to experience deity. However, we are told that the human being is the flower of evolution at this stage of evolution, and the source of it, whatever it is, must be there. And so we'll just leave it at that.
Well, we did want to mention that this is the importance of the duality of mind. It is very difficult for our lower mind, which is intellectual, which is wrapped up in desire, which is influenced by perceptions of objects of sense, which defines and makes clarifications by distinction, to grasp and have a concept of that which is infinite, eternal, without beginning or ending, and has no attributes at all. And this is why, for many people, functioning primarily through the influence of the lower mind, the highest concept that they can perceive of deity is that of a being with certain, perhaps human attributes, but a being with some kind of limitations, because at least they can grasp it in the mind. That's different, as Theosophy points out, and many writers point out, between the intuitive feeling of the reality and presence of the spiritual divine principle of life. That intuitive sense through the higher mind that there is something more, something that transcends, something that is eternal, that never was, is, or will have an ending, infinite, within and without all things. That we're calling the deific principle, as a philosophical concept to distinguish it from the idea in our minds of a being. But really, we have to go within ourselves and begin to sense if there is something in us that transcends the personality, something that we sense is above and beyond, that has no beginning, no end, that part of ourselves which is divine. Then we can begin to sense the reality of that which is universally eternal and divine, or that deific reality.
Yes, in the back.
Well, does the philosophy then state that spirit and matter are really, could be the opposite ends of the pole? In other words, spirit needs something to act through. Matter needs something to ignite it. So could we look at it again as maybe the same but yet the opposite ends of the pole?
Right, so then could we look at spirit and matter as the same coin, two sides of the same coin, or opposite ends of a pole? it's helpful to consider that when we consider the higher and the lower mind, because remember, while we're in incarnation, to learn and grow, we have to. There has to be what friction of, you know, of one versus the other. That doesn't mean there has to be war and peace. You don't have to go to the incredible extreme of war to understand what peace is. You know, you don't have to go, you know, to you don't have to have a hurricane or burn under a scorching sun to know the difference between a cloudy day and a sunny day. You know, we don't have to go to that extreme, but we do need the contrast to learn and grow from.
One expression that we've always found helpful is the idea that matter is crystallized spirit, and spirit is etherealized matter. So they're all there in potential. It's to what degree each is expressed at a particular time. Yes.
Well, we can recall back in the 30s that when the milkman came and we brought a bottle, and we noticed that there were two levels of milk, quote, in that bottle. Yet today, when you buy a bottle of milk, it's all the same. Yet we know that the milk hasn't changed. Never has changed. What did we do to that milk so that we no longer see two layers in the bottle?
We think it's homogenized. Is that what they, we shake it up?
You're old enough to remember, aren't you?
We think that now these days we prefer the milk that has, and the yogurt that has a little bit of the cream on top. Get us back to our roots, yes. Well, yes, this whole process of blending and separation, so an ongoing process of nature. Actually, part of the discussion of what happens after death is if we understand our human nature as being a synthesis, a coming together of the various principles of nature, death is just that process of separation into the eternal parts of our nature from the temporary, what goes on and endures and what returns back to nature. So, well, there's so many ways we can think of it, but keep in mind always, there is, matter was never created out of nothing. We have this idea, perhaps in our Western minds, perhaps from our religious upbringing, that there was a creation of matter. Matter has substance, has eternally existed. The way it expresses itself, the various forms it takes, those forms have a beginning and ending, but substance eternally is. At the same time, the other co-eternal enmeshed principle with that, because you can't have matter without that energy and force that sustains it. Spirit has always existed. We don't speak of a time when spirit or soul is created. It eternally is. And yet the degree to which it manifests, the plane on it, which it's working, can have its beginning and end. We can say there's a beginning and end to the incarnation of a spiritual being on earth, but not a beginning or ending to the duration of that spiritual entity, in essence. So these things are eternal, only their manifestations come and go, have beginnings and endings. Yes?
Thinking of the lower mind and the higher mind, and how the lower mind maybe is more selfishly, physically oriented, the higher mind more spiritually, more selflessly oriented. However, we're still physical and we're still spiritual, so that means that we have to integrate them somehow. The homogenization of the milk is a nice analogy. However, I think that the higher mind could be seen maybe to be utilizing the lower mind in a way, transforming the desires or the negative aspects of it and just kind of purifying it to be a better tool to work through this world that we live in.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Okay. So, in essence, what we're asking here is the higher mind by definition good, and is the lower mind by definition bad, or can the lower mind be used for productive purposes? Well, that's why we incarnate. The higher mind doesn't think logically. The lower mind does. The lower mind reasons from premise to conclusion, and that's not a bad thing. What's very helpful is in our pursuits as students to understand life more, to rely on our intuition in principle and to act when we feel like there's a glimpse of a guidance from the higher, act on that. Sometimes we'll find what I thought was a glimpse from the higher is really my own personal desires just kind of confusing me, but act on it. And as a result of that, look back on whatever it is that you're doing. If it was intuition coming through, you will know that it was intuition because it will be logical, even though at the moment one might not have been able to use logic to reason to go in a particular direction, yet that particular direction might be the right way to do it. If at the end it never really did make sense to do that, then it probably wasn't guidance from the higher mind. So yes, it's one whole, it's all a matter of how we do it and how clear-minded we are in terms of discerning personal stuff, you know, personal desires. So we'll leave it at that.
See, here's the proof to us of the unity of mind, even though we speak of a higher and lower mind. So you recall we were speaking of the higher and the lower and how we observe it does this and one thing. But within the very language we use is the realization that there is part of our nature that is observing. We say we do this or we do that or we let the higher mind do this and the higher mind. Well, what is it that's observing those two actions? It's the mind being. It's ourselves as thinkers. But what we're observing as mind beings is the two ways in which that principle can be active in our nature. There are some human beings who predominantly are aware of the activity of the lower mind, predominantly influenced through their intellect, their passions, their sensory experience. There are some human beings on this earth who are predominantly, even though they experience that same, they are more influenced by the intuitional, the altruistic, the inspirational. They are more in tune with that higher. And many of us, most of us, are a mix. And that's where our inner, we might say, battle. That's the battle of the devotee of any religious aspiration, to bring into balance that part of our nature which tends towards separation and selfishness, that part of nature which moves to and feels the inspiration of the divine, to bringing the two into accord.
What do you call it? Is it the same as like the stomach mind? Like, you know, they say that you have a mind in your stomach as well, or like one of the other things is the power center that people talk about, either in like martial arts and or yoga philosophy, like that type of correlation.
Right. Well, certainly there's a lot of philosophies that talk about the correlations between the metaphysical aspect of the human being and the physical aspect. Everything that's physical has its corresponding metaphysical. Theosophy so much doesn't get into the particulars of that. And so you'd be hard-pressed to really find much along those lines. We'll leave it at that. In the brown shirt, was there a hand raised earlier?
Yes, we're wondering, as far as good and evil goes, all religions at their core have the golden rule. However, it's not followed. It seems like there's much evil that comes out of religions, and almost without exception, we can just think perhaps Buddhism and Jainism, perhaps, or they've been able to not turn into evil against their neighbors. So what's that with the... And there can be good that comes out of evil and evil that comes out of good as well.
So the question here is, you know, what is it about good and evil that would correspond to the higher and the lower mind? And actually, yes, we've heard that there has never been a war fought in the name of Buddha. How many other religions can say that? But when it comes to good and evil, so many religions talk about the God and the devil, and really, theosophically speaking, if we look at it from the point of view of the duality of mind, you know, the God and the devil are within the human body. And where is our consciousness? Or it's within the human mind, we should say. Where is our consciousness? What are we doing? You know, it's only a human being that has a mind on planet Earth. And it's only a human being that can actually be, you know, that can actually do evil things. A wolf doesn't do evil things. A wolf will kill to eat, but that's not an evil thing. So this whole good and evil, it becomes a little bit easier to discern. You know, if one, you know, if we all have this dual mind, then many who are of the same mindset, imagine the good that many like-minded individuals can impress into the world, and the reverse, unfortunately. So the idea here for the student of theosophy then is, don't accept this stuff passively. Don't say, well, you know, I heard it there, it must be true. No. Be receptive to it and check it, test it, verify what's being said here, because what's being said here is a lot different from what's being said at a lot of church and synagogues down the road. But you wouldn't be here if there wasn't a reason for it. And if an individual is attracted to these ideas, sincerely attracted, and has some level of enthusiasm, not fanaticism, but enthusiasm for these ideas, that enthusiasm, the God within, carries through from life to life. And so if in the first time you walk in this lodge, one feels enthused about these ideas, like there's something going on here, it's probably because, well, maybe the first time you've been in this lodge, but it's probably not at all the first time you've been in or a part of the Great Lodge.
Well, so, no, I'll just say that.
About 2 minutes.
But just to finish up, good and evil, it's a talk in itself. Mm-hmm. But we all know good and evil's relative. What's good to one person's evil to another. What we thought was good at one point in our life is evil at another, and vice versa. So when we start with this idea, it's because of the duality of nature, spirit working through substance. Spirit is intelligence, it's consciousness, it's awareness, but it has to get involved in form for experience and also to raise up the substance to a higher degree. And it's in that context, it's in that involvement that spirit intelligence gets diluted and identifies with the form. And because it forgets, spirit forgets, or soul forgets what it essentially is, and is not free from the influence of matter, it makes all sorts of mistakes, consciously or unconsciously, and we have generated by the effects of those actions what we call evil. On the other hand, good would be the operation of spirit and substance with knowledge and control of what its real nature is.
So with that, we'll just finish up with a statement. It was from a letter from a master. The occult science is not one in which secrets can be communicated of a sudden or written or even verbal communication. It is the common mistake of people that we willingly wrap ourselves and our powers in mystery. The truth is that till the student attains to the condition necessary for that degree to which and for which he is entitled and fitted, most, if not all, of the secrets are incommunicable. The receptivity must be equal to the desire to instruct. The illumination must come from within. So our meeting is adjourned.
Get this off here. Yeah.